Blog Talk Radio.
And a good Monday afternoon to everybody. This is John Gresham, and we are talking about Military Monday, which we are doing today as a means of going ahead and fixing something that happened last week as a direct result of the Boston bombing. As many of you may have noticed from the media, there wasn't a lot on television, radio, or in any news medium that did not involve the terrorist attack in Boston, which is perhaps as it should be. But along the way, we lost out on getting to see a lot of other important stories, including one which particularly resonates with me. Down in Florida, a very, very exclusive club gathered, and when I mean exclusive, only three of them were able to show up. These are the men who, some 71 years ago, went and flew the very first U.S. retaliatory strike on Tokyo after Pearl Harbor. We are talking about the Doolittle Tokyo Raiders. Now, a lot of Americans don't know the Raiders. They don't even know that they did this thing. It is something that is slowly fading into the distance. But before we let it happen, we're going to do a show just about the Tokyo Raiders, what they did, and what happened last week down in Northwest Florida when they commemorated the very last meeting of what is known as the Tokyo Raider Society. We're going to start the show today with someone who is our first two-time guest, Barrett Tillman, an aviation historian based in Arizona, an old friend and co-author of mine who has written on the Tokyo Raiders and has even met some of the Tokyo Raiders over the years. Barrett, are you there, my friend?
I'm locked and loaded. Let's get this pony on the road.
Okay. And we got a big story to tell. And the first one is, who was Jimmy Doolittle? It's an interesting name. I doubt a lot of Americans under the age of 50 even know who he was, but if you were a young man in 1941 and you were interested in flying, who was Jimmy Doolittle to you?
Jimmy Doolittle in 1941 probably was the Joe DiMaggio of aviation, leaving aside Charles Lindbergh as the Babe Ruth of aviation, but in truth, without taking anything away from Lucky Lindy, Jimmy Doolittle was arguably the most accomplished airman of the 20th century. He was not only a superb stick and rudder man, he was extremely bright. He had both a master's and a doctorate in aeronautics at a time when probably you could count the number of aeronautics PhDs in this country on the fingers of both hands. Record-setting test pilot, a brilliant aerobatic pilot, and one of the major factors in preparing the United States Army Air Forces for World War II, because General Jimmy, as we came to know him much later, not only pioneered instrument flight, but he also was the midwife between Shell Oil and the Army Air Force in developing high-octane gasoline. So you could hardly swing a cat in aviation in the 1940s without scratching something that Doolittle had done.
And it's correct that Doolittle did things that other pilots simply could not accomplish, taming low-stability aircraft like the GB and actually flying a completely blind flight from takeoff to landing and never actually seeing outside the cockpit, correct?
That's correct. He was loaned by the Army to the Sperry Gyroscope Company in the late 1920s, and he told me in our first interview that that was almost anticlimactic because he had done so many blind takeoffs and landings, what pilots call under the hood, that is, with a shroud over the cockpit and relying only on instruments, that In those practice lights, he had what he called a safety pilot, and that was one who could look outside in the second cockpit. And Doolittle said by the time he actually proved the concept and the equipment, I think in 1929, he was supremely confident. And that sense of confidence and subdued competence came across with Doolittle more than any other aviation celebrity I've known. He was very much a self-composed, extremely bright, yet thoroughly knowledgeable individual. And the thing I most remember that struck me about him the first time we met was his precise way of speaking, not only his selection of words, but his enunciation. For instance, he said aeroplane rather than airplane. And he almost had a British affectation. He would refer to his friends as chaps. So General Jimmy was—he was unique.
And somewhere along the way, this quiet, gentle, precise, studious man also learned to be one hell of a leader.
Well, he certainly did. Not only did he lead from the front in every military command he ever had, which included the 12th Air Force in Africa, the 15th Air Force in Italy, and the 8th Air Force in Europe. But if when he was at the test facility at Dayton, Ohio, old Cook Field, the predecessor of today's Wright-Patterson, if there were a particularly challenging or dangerous test hop to be done, Jimmy Doolittle's usually the one who stood first in line to do it.
And one of his better friends in the world of aviation was another senior leader in what was then the Army Air Forces, Hap Arnold, the head of the Army Air Forces. And what did Hap Arnold have him doing at the beginning of World War II?
Well, Doolittle had been a reserve officer his entire career, and then left active duty in the 20s in order to work with the aviation department of Shell Oil. And in 1941, Hap Arnold, who was then relatively new as the chief of the Army Air Forces, recalled then-Major Doolittle to active duty as the special projects officer. And at that time, Arnold did not have anything specifically in mind. Remember, this was shortly before Pearl Harbor. But immediately after 7 December 1941, Arnold called Jimmy, and they had known each other for decades, and they were on a first-name basis, and they called him in and said, Jimmy, the president wants to hit back at Japan as soon as possible. Investigate that, see what's possible, and report back to me. So Doolittle was in on the ground floor of what became the Tokyo raid. But officially, it was designated the first special aviation project, and Doolittle subsequently was promoted to lieutenant colonel and was not originally going to fly the mission, but he knew enough about the military bureaucracy that he did left-hand, right-hand between Arnold and his chief of staff. And by the time the Raiders were ready to go, Doolittle had written himself a set of orders, not only commanding the operation, but leading the first airplane.
Now, explain the problem of going and trying to hit Japan after Pearl Harbor, and where did the idea come for launching twin-engine medium Army bombers off of a U.S. Navy aircraft carrier?
That's one of the ironic aspects of the story, John. The concept originated with a Navy officer, a captain, which is the equivalent of an Army colonel, who was the chief anti-submarine warfare officer on Admiral King's staff and the chief of naval operations. And during an inspection tour of bases in Florida, he looked down and saw an aircraft carrier target outlined on a bombing range, and that got him to thinking, if we could get a carrier with twin-engine Army bombers close enough to Japan. We could launch them. They could hit targets in the Japanese home islands and proceed on to the China coast to land at prepared fields there. So Captain Lowe brought up the concept to King. King, in turn, called Arnold. Arnold called President Roosevelt. And long story short, the first special aviation project was born.
Now, the idea was to be able to launch far enough out from the Japanese coast that they wouldn't run into patrol aircraft and hopefully picket ships, because there was no way they could do that trying to use conventional carrier aircraft, which were relatively short range, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. The rule of thumb in 1941 was about 200 nautical miles mission radius for carrier bombers. So the carrier assigned to the Doolittle mission, the USS Hornet, was brand new. She had only been in commission, I think, since October of 1941, and the raid, of course, occurred in the middle of April. The problem was that the scheduled launch distance, as I recall, was about 450 miles east of Tokyo. But on the morning of the 18th, many hours before anticipated, the task force with the Hornet and her escorting sister ship, the Enterprise, encountered Japanese picket ships roughly 600 miles at sea. And the Americans were busted at that point. They had been seen. They couldn't sink the picket ships quickly enough to prevent them from warning the mainland. So there went the built-in fudge factor for the B-25s. They launched as quickly as possible. They were still able to hit the targets, but by the time they got to the China coast, they were extremely low on fuel. I think they had been airborne between 12 and 13 hours, and they began running out of gas. And only one of the 16 B-25s landed safely anywhere, and that was one which had diverted to Russian territory.
Now, what you were just talking about, taking a twin-engine medium Army bomber of World War II off of an aircraft carrier, that was kind of a unique feat for the day. Talk a little bit about how you do that, and how do you go and train and assemble a squadron of crews, 80 men, to do that. And don't leave out the fact that this took place at a rather interesting place down in the Northwest Florida region.
Launching twin-engine bombers from aircraft carriers, to my knowledge, had never been attempted because there had never been a need for it before Captain Lowe came up with the concept. This was around February of 1942, so barely 2 months after Pearl Harbor. The Army provided two B-25s to the Hornet, which was then operating out of Norfolk, Virginia, and they were the airplanes were lightly loaded, but still, you didn't want to overload them for a preliminary test. And two crews were provided, and they found that with about 25 to 30 knots of relative wind over the deck, that is the combined speed of the ship's forward motion and steaming into a brisk wind, the bombers could get off without much difficulty. So the results were reported to Doolittle, and he had only considered two possible airplanes, the B-25 and the B-26, and he immediately rejected the Martin Marauder because it was a relatively fast airplane with high wing loading, and that means that the aerodynamic load on the wings was fairly high, and it was lower on the B-25, which would permit a slower takeoff speed. So enter the 17th Bomb Group, which was the first B-25 unit that we ever had, and at the time that the mission concept arose, the 17th was based at my hometown, Pendleton, Oregon, in northeastern part of the state, flying anti-submarine patrols up and down the Pacific coast. Well, because Doolittle wanted experienced crews in B-25s, that meant he looked no further. And subsequently, the 17th group was transferred to South Carolina. And at that point, Doolittle entered the picture, conducted a locked room meeting with the air crews, and told them that he was looking for about 20 crews. He wanted some spares for a highly classified mission that would take them out of the U.S. for several months. And he said, anybody who's interested, step forward. And everybody in the room stepped forward. So from that point, it was a matter of sorting out the more experienced crews. And remember, at this time, the B-25 was still fairly new, and so were a lot of the pilots, both the left-seaters and right-seaters, the co-pilots. And a good many of them had only received their wings a matter of several months to a year before. So Doolittle chose the most likely prospects and then took them with their airplanes down to Eglin Field. And there they began, in test pilot terms, pushing the envelope, learning just how quickly, in how short a distance, you could take off a loaded B-25. And they had a couple of Navy instructors to show them the technique. And in a matter of just a few weeks, everybody was qualified. They went aboard the Hornet. Rotor, well, I take that back. The Hornet came west through the Panama Canal. The bombers flew cross-country and landed in the San Francisco area, loaded aboard the Hornet in Alameda, California, and from there they headed for Tokyo.
Now, I'm sure it wasn't on their mind at the time, but there they were inventing Air Force Special Operations at what is today the home of Air Force Special Operations. The subsidiary fields around Eglin Air Force Base, what we call Eglin Air Force Base today, were in fact eventually turned into Hurlburt Field, where AFSOC is based. The irony here is just amazing when you consider that they were doing this with no guidebook. They were just doing it out of their heads, and 70 years later, we're talking about the cradle of AFSOC.
That's exactly right. Air Force Spec Ops is dated from the Doolittle operation in early 1942.
Now, they get out to Alameda. They're winched aboard the Hornet. And, of course, this is a very classified operation. It's a black operation, as we would say today. And yet, there it is in front of God and everybody in the San Francisco Bay Area, being hidden in plain sight. The bombers are aboard the Hornet. They go out right under the Golden Gate Bridge, and yet the word doesn't get out, and they head out to the North Pacific. What happens then? What happens when they get out to sea, and finally the Navy crew is told what they're going to do?
Well, the Hornet and her escorts, cruisers and destroyers, were told to rendezvous with other ships north of Midway. And for those who don't know the geography, Midway Island is the last of the Hawaiian Islands. It's about 1,100 or 1,200 miles northwest of Honolulu. And there, by golly, was the Hornet's sister Enterprise, which was to escort the Hornet to Japan and back, with a similar composition of cruisers and destroyers. So that told everybody that this was no short-term hit-and-run operation such as we had done in the Central Pacific. Obviously, they were headed someplace else. And I think it was that evening, after the two task forces had rendezvoused, that Vice Admiral Halsey, who commanded the task force from the Enterprise, let it be known. He said, this task force is headed for Tokyo. And the guys who were aboard both ships, and I've just done a history of the Enterprise, said that just bedlam broke loose. Here it was, lo, these many months after Pearl Harbor, when every American's craving was payback for Pearl Harbor against the Japanese Empire. And these guys were the ones who were going to do it. And morale was already high, and it just went through the overhead. And every man in the task force was supremely proud to be involved in our first slap back at Japan.
What were the takeoff conditions on the morning of the 18th? You mentioned that they had to leave early, but that wasn't the only problem. I mean, the takeoff conditions were not as planned. In fact, they were downright dangerous and horrible, were they not?
Well, I wouldn't say they were horrible, but they were certainly not optimum. The weather in the Western Pacific that time of year can be pretty rough, and there were high winds, rough seas, and consequently, the launch procedure for each of the bombers was in the hands of the Navy flight deck officer, and he had to gauge visually the rise and fall of the Hornet's bow. And once he saw what the timing was and he got into that sequence, depending on where a particular B-25 was in the pack, that is how far back it was on the flight deck, the launch officer would give the go signal. And in some of those farther back with a longer takeoff run, the pilot said they were actually looking slightly downward as the bow pitched low in the trough of the wave. And by the time the bow came up, the airplane was just lifting off and was in no danger of hitting any of the high waves. So that launch evolution, I believe, lasted over an hour. It was about 5 minutes between each of the 16 aircraft. So I guess actually that would have been closer to 90 minutes. But anyway, each of the airplanes had a brief target. They were to strike specific military and industrial targets in Tokyo and five other cities, including Yokohama and Nagoya. And the amazing thing was that the Doolittle and the first few Raiders arrived over Tokyo around noon local time, which coincided with a practice air raid drill. So people, including the Japanese military, looked up and saw airplanes low over Tokyo and didn't recognize them as what a later generation would call Yankee air pirates. And consequently, very few of the bombers were intercepted. I think only I'm going to guess maybe two or three actually saw Japanese fighters over Tokyo and in that area, and they all dropped their bombs with reasonable accuracy and got away clean.
Now, in a day and age where we're used to commanding officers being in what look like hardened mission control centers today when they go into combat, where was Jimmy Doolittle and what was he doing on this morning?
Jimmy Doolittle was a 45-year-old professional airman. He was sitting in the left-hand seat of the number one B-25. And remember, this was on-the-job training, even though all the crews had been through what today we would call field carrier landing practice back in Florida. Nobody had been able to take off from a carrier in a fully loaded B-25. So this was showtime.
He was being a lab rat.
Yeah, he was.
He was going to show everybody else how it was done.
That's exactly right. And he needed to do it perfectly because being at the front end of the pack, that meant he had less of a deck run than any of the pilots behind him. But he said he had complete confidence in the technique they had learned in Florida. And if you look at that famous black and white footage you've seen so many times on television, Jimmy hauled that thing into the air. He said the control yoke was in his chest, and with that relative wind that I mentioned earlier, the high sustaining lift that comes from the generated wind. He got the altitude he needed almost immediately. Then he and his co-pilot, Bob Cole, shoved hard forward on the yoke in order to avert a stall. And you'll see the airplane begins to settle somewhat toward the water, but they timed it extremely well. They got the nose level, sucked up the gear, pulled up the flaps, and he made one circuit, left-hand circuit, over the ship to get the bearing that he needed, and he was off for Tokyo. Now, a lot of your listeners may have seen that horrible Pearl Harbor movie with Alec Baldwin, who was absolutely putrid in the role of Jimmy Doolittle. And if you want to know what I really think about it, I'll tell you after we hang up. But the film showed a formation of B-25s, basically doing the Schweinfurt and Regensburg tactics of the 8th Air Force with B-17s. That is a formation of airplanes bucking and yawing through heavy flak. But that's definitely not true because, as I said, they didn't have the fuel to form up and go out as a group, and there was no need to from a tactical purpose either because each pilot had a specific target. So each of the airplanes arrived independently and hit their targets alone and then headed for their rendezvous on the China coast.
And for those who want to see a really good representation of the Doolittle Raid, go ahead and pick up something called 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, an Academy Award-winning film made in 1944 by Melvin Leroy, starring no less than Spencer Tracy as Jimmy Doolittle. And even today is one of the gold standards for a technically correct military film. Correct, Barrett?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, by 1944, the secret was out. Originally, President Roosevelt had said, excuse me, that the bombers came from Shangri-La, which was the subject of another well-regarded movie, pre-war, I think. But the level of technical accuracy in the movie, which is based on the memoir by Captain Ted Lawson, one of the raiders, is extraordinarily high. And in fact, it's so good that you'll see film clips from 30 Seconds Over Tokyo in some other World War II movies, including the really, really bad 1976 movie titled Midway. But imagine filming the Doolittle Raiders story after World War II. That would have been really tough, as we saw with the 2001 picture. But in 1944, the Army had more B-25s than it knew what to do with. And General Doolittle said that he thought Spencer Tracy did a good job portraying him because Tracy's on-screen persona is quiet, confident, subdued, and he didn't really resemble Doolittle because Spencer Tracy had a full head of hair. But Doolittle had just a trace, just a smidgen of that hot rock aviator confidence about himself that I don't think that Tracy tried to grasp, but otherwise everybody who was affiliated with the film thought that Tracy did an excellent job of playing Doolittle.
Now, these 16 airplanes didn't carry a lot of bombs. I mean, just 400-500-pound bombs apiece. They hit their individual targets. They didn't do a lot of damage. And in the end, all 16 airplanes were either lost or were interned by the Russians. And yet, it had a massive effect, did it not?
The effect was felt on both sides of the Pacific. In the United States, it was a huge, huge morale boost because when you look at what else was happening in the Pacific in April of 1942, you know, we were losing the Philippines, we had lost Guam, we were in retreat almost everywhere, and then bam, literally overnight, there's bombs on Tokyo. And the the most telling newspaper headline that I've seen in my years of researching it. And I think it might have been the San Francisco Chronicle. It says, Doolittle dude it. And there was a picture of him from before the war. But more importantly, in Tokyo, the Japanese high command was appalled because both the Imperial Navy and the Japanese Army Air Force were responsible for defending the homeland. And some well-regarded admirals had told the government and the emperor that the homeland was inviolate, but nobody could hope them out an air attack there. And then, bam, all of a sudden, 16 olive drab airplanes with white stars on them are roaming almost without opposition. So that convinced the Naval General Staff in Tokyo that job one was destroying America's Pacific Fleet carriers. And consequently, Admiral Yamamoto, commander of the combined fleet, went ahead with the planning for the Midway operation that was going to seize the one target in the Central Pacific that America had to defend. And, of course, that was Midway because it was within air range of Pearl Harbor. And 6 months after Pearl Harbor, almost to the day, the Japanese Navy suffered the irreversible loss with four carriers sunk versus one American carrier sunk, the Yorktown, which was a sister of the Enterprise and the Hornet. And from that point on, Japan was almost totally on the defensive for the rest of the war.
And yet, on the morning after the raid, Doolittle, who, like many of his men, had parachuted into a dark, rainy sky over eastern China, was sitting on a hillside next to the remains of plane number one, and he thought he'd failed. And yet, he had no idea what he'd done or what was ahead of him, did he?
Apparently not. He said, I think that was his third or fourth emergency parachute jump in his career. And he was sitting on the wing of his airplane, and the rest of the airframe was scattered across the Chinese countryside. He was wet, and he was miserable. He'd come down in a rice paddy, and I won't go into details about how rice paddies are fertilized, but he was thoroughly miserable, and his flight engineer, sergeant, came over and sat down beside him after taking his picture, and Doolittle said something to the effect that nobody wants to see a picture of me, and the sergeant said, Colonel, you're going to go home, and they're going to give you the Medal of Honor, and they're going to promote you to general. And the sergeant was entirely correct. Shortly after Doolittle returned to the States, he was immediately promoted to Brigadier General. He skipped full colonel. He was called to the White House. He was presented the Medal of Honor. And from there on, his career just blossomed. He went to North Africa, commanding the Northwestern Desert Air Force, which became part of which became the 12th Air Force. He stood up the 15th Air Force, which incidentally is the subject of my next book, in Italy in late 1943. And then in early 44, he went to Britain, where he commanded the mighty 8th for the rest of the European war. So the Tokyo raid was, yeah, it was spectacular, but it was just the beginning of Doolittle's totally unique record. And by the way, when he commanded the 12th Air Force, he also led a bombing mission on Rome. So he's probably the only air commander in the Second World War who personally bombed two of the three Axis capitals. He didn't get to go to Berlin, and that's only because Hap Arnold wouldn't allow it.
Amazingly, in what more than a few people probably considered a suicide mission at the time, the vast majority of the raiders survived. Most of them went back into service, served during the war. And at the end of the war, after several small reunions during the war, Doolittle got to keep a promise to them that he'd made aboard the Hornet. And talk a little bit about that party and the beginnings of the Tokyo Raider Society.
Well, he had said aboard the ship, I think, that when they got to Shanghai, which was their ultimate destination, he was going to throw them a party that they would remember. Well, he didn't really get a chance to do that because the Chinese government of Chiang Kai-shek provided a state banquet for them. And by the time the war was over, there had been further attrition. Three of the eight raiders who were captured were murdered. The Japanese said executed, but they were murdered. Another one died of starvation. And I don't remember exactly, but a few others died during the war. But in 1946, I believe, the first reunion was held at General Doolittle's expense. And it was a barn burner. It was a real good time. And he said in talking to Joe, his wife, thereafter, that he simply couldn't afford the amount of booze that those guys could suck up. So over a period of a few other reunions that were jointly sponsored, some of the wives began attending, and Doolittle said that that kind of toned down the animal house aspects, but those guys had plenty to celebrate, and of course they had gone through a completely unique experience together, and that kind of bonding cannot be experienced otherwise, and that's why the Doolittle Raiders Association has remained such a tight-knit bunch for these 70 years now.
Barrett, I'd like you to stay on the line so we can talk to you perhaps a little later, and I'd like to bring on our second guest. For those of you who may not be familiar with Major General Rich Comer, Rich is a retired two-star who was the deputy commander for Air Force Special Operations when he retired. This is a gentleman who's had an extraordinary career within Air Force Special Operations, including leading the task force that fired the first shots into a pair of Iraqi radar stations during Operation Desert Storm. We are very, very pleased to have him with us today, and let's try and bring him on. Rich, are you there, sir? Hello, Rich.
Hello, John. How are you? John,
very
I'm here.
Good.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, we can. And okay. You obviously have been listening to the end of our description of the raid. Talk a little bit about the Raider Society and the kind of organization it has evolved into up to its final meeting last week, please.
Well, I believe all of the families and everybody have become part of the organization, and it has all of these members because 80 families, as you can imagine, is quite a number. At the reunion here in Fort Walton Beach last week, over 200 family members attended, and a lot of them expressed a desire to continue having reunions, even though the Raiders themselves announced that this reunion here in Fort Walton Beach would be the final reunion. So it is quite an organization, and it doesn't want to evaporate.
That said, there were only three of the original Raiders that were able to attend last week's celebrations, correct?
Correct. We had Dick Cole, who was the co-pilot for Doolittle, 97 years old. Ed Saylor, who was a flight engineer on ship number 15, and David Thatcher, who was on Ted Lawson's aircraft, which was number 7. Those three men attended. I think all of them were in their 90s, the youngest being 92 years old.
And obviously the rest of the Raiders have passed on, but from the very beginning, this was a unique organization. It was an organization that had even planned before the very last meeting. And they had done so in a rather European fashion, something that the Europeans like to call a tontine. And it involved a bottle of cognac. Please tell that story.
Well, yes, I think General Doolittle, at a certain point, admiring the alcohol consumption of the group and saluting it in a way, bought a bottle of Hennessy cognac, a vintage bottle, and he placed it in a case. And also they bought 80 silver goblets. And each silver goblet had the name of a raider printed on it two times. It was printed on it right side up and upside down. And as the raiders passed on, as we say, they would turn his cup over with the intent that at the last reunion, when there were only two raiders, they would open the bottle of cognac and drink it. Now, the case displaying the cognac and the cups, Doolittle gave to the U.S. Air Force Academy for safekeeping, and it was kept at the cadet social, the social building, Arnold Hall, which had the movie theater in the place where they held all the dances and the graduation ball and such like that. It was there for several years, and then at one point moved to the Air Force Museum and stayed in Dayton for a while. And at each reunion, they have this case, and it comes, and it also has a tradition that a couple of Air Force Academy cadets travel with it as ceremonial guards. And this case was at every event that they had last week here in Fort Walton Beach until Wednesday night or Thursday night. And Thursday night being April 18th, and the final reunion of the Raiders, they scheduled the opening of the bottle and consumption of the cognac was scheduled for Thursday night. I have done all I could do to confirm that they actually did drink it Thursday night. I met with the two cadets and an officer escort of theirs, and I asked, when are they going to open up the bottle? And he said, tomorrow night, and this was Wednesday. So they said, tomorrow night, and I looked at their schedule. Their schedule was very full, Wednesday through Saturday, except for Thursday. That Thursday evening was reserved for them to have a private time. And that was for the purpose of opening that bottle and drinking it. I did meet a member of the Fort Walton Beach Military Affairs Committee who was in charge of the hospitality room that they had for the Raiders. And he was there as the, if you want to come to the hospitality room, I'm serving drinks. And, of course, all of the families were there and everything, and he was the bartender. And he said that they went late on Tuesday evening, and he had to give up and go home, and one of the Raiders told him to go ahead. They could pour their own drinks. So at least one of those 90-something-year-olds was still in the hospitality room when the person taking care of it had to go home. Well,
I think it's pretty reliable
that they opened that bottle on Thursday night, the 18th, the actual day anniversary of bombing Japan, and all had a sip.
What other activities were scheduled during the week, and what did you see at these activities?
Well, I went to a couple of them, and they were, each event had its own flavor and its own purpose. They had the local college, Northwest Florida State College, There's a small four-year college that's right here outside of Eglin, and the college itself is only 50 years old. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary, in fact, this year, and the first event of their celebration of their 50th anniversary was a opening of a historical exhibit of the Doolittle Raiders, which they placed right in the front of their basketball arena. And it's there for people to come and see whenever they attend any of their sporting events. And it is a very nice display of the history of the Raiders. And the reason that they did this is that 50 years ago, when they named their sports teams, they named them the Raiders, after the Doolittle Raiders, because they trained here in town. And so the Raiders athletic team has the historical exhibit, which is very nice if you care to come and visit it, right here in just outside the west gate of Eglin Air Force Base, and about 3 miles down into the town. It's actually in a town called Niceville, Florida, which is a great name for a town, I think. But it's
a rather pleasant place.
Well, I think so. I live there. So they had that as the first event with the college. And, of course, the cognac in its case was there on display along in each of the three Raiders was there. None of them were asked to speak. They did just kind of attended and got some tokens of appreciation from the college that they've kept their sports team named after them. And they nodded appreciation. Right after that, moved to hangar on Eglin Air Force Base, maintenance hangar for the 33rd TAC Fighter Wing, which is right by the runway that they first parked their B-25. And they named a maintenance hangar there after Ed Saylor. Now, Saylor's story was the main reason that they did this. Saylor being the flight engineer on ship number 15, and ship number 15 had an engine that was not performing correctly, and it was on the carrier that they realized that they needed a new engine or deco level maintenance. And Doolittle told Saylor, fix it or we're going to shove the ship overboard and let it sink in the Pacific. And Saylor said, I can fix it. And he, with the help of some Navy mechanics, he removed the engine from the wing, took it below decks, and took it apart. And you can imagine the Raiders did not travel with books of tech data on how to do depot maintenance on engines, so he was on his own. He dismantled the engine, and like I say, no, he didn't have the book on how to put the engine together, so he just had to remember where each of the parts and pieces went after he found the problem, did what he could to fix it, and then reassembled the engine. They hung it back on the airplane, test ran it, and they said it's good to go for the mission. Now, that bit of maintenance was great. Now, at the time, Saylor was a corporal, and he eventually remained in the Air Corps during the war, but eventually he was given a battlefield promotion during the war and became a maintenance officer. And he had a career as a maintenance officer and retired in the 1960s as a lieutenant colonel. So the hangar, maintenance hangar there at Eglin was named after him. And that was a nice ceremony. One thing they did not expect, they had a historian there to tell the story. And, of course, the wing commander there had a nice speech to talk about all of the things that Saylor did aboard the ship. But Saylor said he could speak to it after they handed him the plaque saying why the hangar was dedicated to his name. And he went up to a podium and he gave a speech. There in the hangar in front of 1,000 people, he spoke for 12 minutes and he gave as good a speech as you could hear. And everybody marveling at this 90-something-year-old who just did this. And he sat down, and the wing commander just approached the podium and said, "Hey, my speech is no good. It's all the details have been done better by the guy who did it." And so he kind of looked through his pages and read the conclusion of his speech, and everybody clapped. And then they had a small news conference there in the hangar right after with all three of the Raiders there to answer questions with a lot of the media and the local press. The next day, a luncheon at the next day was Thursday, and they had the luncheon at the fairgrounds, at Fort Walton Beach Fairgrounds, with a lot of people there. And it was also allowed for some autographing and that kind of thing afterwards. And then the rest of Thursday, the Raiders had to themselves in the cognac. Friday, they had another luncheon at the fairgrounds, specifically for veterans of World War II and Korea and their families to kind of meet the Raiders. And all the families came as well of the Raiders. And that was a pretty good affair. With also Gulf War veterans, because there are a lot of them here from Eglin's fighter wing and from AFSOC, who have retired in the area, and they all attended. There was also a dinner that night that was fairly informal. They had a parade with the Raiders being the grand marshals of the parade on Saturday. All of the kids in Fort Walton Beach and everywhere around here were out there waving their American flags. One thing I would say that has characterized all of the events is that you could walk around and see any number of people with tears running down their face. They were emotional or just getting to meet or see or be up close to men who did this kind of a mission in World War II. And everything that they heard about it. So it was a pretty nice affair, a big banquet held by the Fort Walton Beach Chamber of Commerce, and all of that Saturday night. And that was the end of the reunion. Over to you, John.
Rich, we're coming up towards the end of the show, and I'd like to just get you and Barrett to give me a few thoughts. And from you, you are a career Air Force Special Operations professional. And as Barrett and I were discussing earlier, this in many ways was the very first Air Force Special Operation. They were making it up as they went. How, in your mind, as a AFSOC professional throughout your entire career, where does the Doolittle Raid sit in terms of the lineage of your community? And what lessons does it teach that are still being used by AFSOC professionals today in the 21st century?
Well, the biggest thing that we are dealing with today is we look at what we have to do and might have to do in the world is something that is has its own buzzwords these days, and that's anti-access. If you can't get a base and set up a base of operations someplace near where you need to accomplish a military objective, it can prevent you from doing it. Now, the Doolittle Raiders had that problem in World War II, and they solved it by having a floating base and an aircraft carrier and learning how to use it. And they took aircraft that were on the basically off the shelf, from the conventional forces and made them unconventional. And they made them unconventional by adding a few things to the aircraft to do the unconventional mission, in this case extra fuel, and they had to take off a lot of weight from the aircraft to do that. And then with the extra fuel, they then did training so that the crews could do special things. In this case, short takeoff, low level flying, and really being on your own out there. As your other guest said, each aircraft was pretty much on its own as it went to from the ship to Japan and into China or Russia. And that is still what we're doing today. If you look at any access problems that we've had, we needed bases close up in the Haiti operation. And we had two aircraft carriers devoted to carrying Army helicopters and being a base of operations for Army helicopters in the Haiti operation in order to put special operations helicopters within range of Afghanistan. They were aboard a carrier in south of Pakistan out there in the ocean, and they crossed to Pakistan to get into Afghanistan for some of those initial missions. And we solve anti-access problems today also with aerial refueling and longer-range aircraft. In this case, in NASA's case these days, they're looking at the V-22 and the C-130s as they do that. But if you look at the C-130s in ASOT that do special missions, some of them are gunships and some of them are mobility assets to carry cargo and troops. We've added the special equipment that they need and have done that in a variety of ways. But initially, the ones that were built first were, you know, somebody's idea on a napkin. And then they go out there and they ask some of the maintenance guys, hey, could we do this? And then the maintenance guys are out there, you know, saying, yeah, I think we can strap that on this aircraft. We can do that. And they go out and try it, and eventually it becomes a new capability. That kind of thing is what was done in the first Air Commando group. Dick Cole, the co-pilot of Jimmy Doolittle's aircraft, ended up serving most of the rest of the war in the first Air Commando group, doing some of that stuff, taking aircraft that you can get, modifying them a little bit to see what you can do, and then doing special training with the crews and go out and make something happen. A lot of innovation, a lot of, you know, what could we do? Think about it, think outside the box, and go do it. Right now, Air Force Special Operations has a group of small aircraft that they've procured that are basically off-the-shelf commercial airplane. They've added long-range radios to them. They've added a little bit of extra capability on how to get the cargo in and out, and maybe some other things that they may need. In one case, they bought some PC-12s, single-engine airplane, and some range. They made ISR, intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance aircraft out of them by putting sensors on them and putting them out there. Now, we hear a lot about drones or UAVs doing that kind of mission. When they didn't have enough of it, ASOC took a small single-engine airplane that was pretty cheap, stuck some sensors on it, and sent it out there to add to the fight. And now they have a fleet of about 30 of them. So those kinds of things are the heritage of Air Force Special Operations, and we always look at the Doolittle Raiders as the first ones that showed us how to do it.
Barrett, are you still with us, sir?
Yes, sir. I'm here.
You and I are historians by trade, and we tend to take the long view on things. As you look back 71 years at the Doolittle Raid, where does it sit, not just in the history of warfare or even air power, but how does it sit there in American history, and what does it mean to us today to be able to look back and see what Jimmy Doolittle and his Raiders did?
I would describe it in one word, John, and that is innovation. Americans historically have been superb innovators, and you need look no further than the invention of the flying machine to prove that. But the thing that most strikes me about the Doolittle raid is not just the daring concept, but how quickly the first special aviation project came about. It was authorized in February, and it launched in April. I can't imagine that in most situations today that the ink would dry on the op order for such things today. Certainly the air commandos, the special operators, are professional innovators. They have to improvise. That's in the DNA of what they do. But when you consider that in the largest war, in the greatest sustained endeavor that the United States has ever undertaken, this concept went from a light bulb clicking on in the mind of a submariner over Florida in February, and 2.5 months later, there's bombs on Tokyo. That is just a lesson for the ages.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you for both sharing your knowledge, your experience, and your observations of this important historical event. Rich, thank you for sharing the story of the last meeting of the Raiders. And Barrett, thank you for reminding us of the details of what these men did. And for all of you who have listened to us today, this is what you missed last week because of the Boston bombing, but we didn't want to let it go by. So for Military Monday, this is John Gresham saying, have a great week, and we'll be back at 1 p.m. Eastern next week. Thank you all.
Bye-bye.